The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Americano podcast, a series of discussions about American politics, power and prejudices. This year, 2024, is an election year in America, a presidential election year. And so we will be doing two podcasts a week rather than our usual one, because we want to and because we know you can't get enough Americano in your life. I am delighted to be joined today by two people instead of one, as we normally do. I'm joined by Innes Stepman, who is a fellow at the Claremont Institute, and Daniel McCarthy, who is editor of Modern Age, which has a very exciting new revamped website, modernagejournal.com. I'd encourage all Americano listeners to go there after they've visited thespectator.co.uk or thespectator.com. And we're going to be talking today about abortion, which has been in the news quite a lot this week. Donald Trump on Sunday, in between truth socialing about a very exciting LIV golf tournament, announced that he was going to make a big statement about abortion. He then did make the statement, and it was, it appears, and I'd like to get both your views on this, an attempt to position himself politically away from where the Democrats want to put Donald Trump and the Republicans on abortion. And he described himself as like Reagan. He doesn't believe in abortion in cases of rape, incest, or threat to the life of the mother. And first of all, well, I'll start with you, Innes. What do you think Trump was trying to do here? And how do you think his position on this has been read by the media? Has it been misread? And so on.
I don't think it's being misread. I'm not sure that this gambit is going to work very well, simply because the left is still going to pin any state law, he says he supports abortion going back to the states, any state law on Trump, it's worked very well for them politically. But in terms of his position, I think it tells us a lot more about who Donald Trump is trying to pull into his camp. He's no longer worried, like in 2016, about pulling in evangelical Christians who vote R. He's no longer super worried about his Republican base. And I think he's probably making the correct political calculation on that one, given the somewhat muted response to this pullback from his abortion position, and also just, you know, poll after poll that shows he has an extremely high approval rate within the Republican Party and among Republican voters.
Dan, do you think this was a clear attempt to signal to independent voters who might be drawn to Trump but aren't drawn to Christian politics that he's not on board with the pro-life movement, or as on board with the pro-life movement as the media would like him to be?
You know, Donald Trump, even in 2016, ran as somewhat middle of the road on many of these issues, not just abortion, but also Second Amendment rights. A number of key conservative issues, Donald Trump signaled that, you know, he was part of a broad conservative coalition, but he actually was not a hardliner the way that people might have expected him to be and the way that the left wanted to present him as. So I actually think that, you know, Donald Trump's statement here is not surprising. This is very much of a piece with the way Donald Trump has presented himself all along. And just as, you know, conservatives in 2016, they may have had some doubts, but then they saw the Supreme Court justices that Donald Trump appointed, and they saw that those justices overturned Roe versus Wade. So I think a lot of conservatives are willing to, you know, go with Trump and give him the benefit of the doubt, even if his own views are not perfectly in alignment with theirs. And I think moderate voters, you know, it's going to be a real contest to see where they come down. There is this feeling among Republicans that they will lose a few points anytime, certainly, that abortion is on the ballot, as it is in Arizona. There's an effort to amend the state constitution to add a protection for abortion rights to the Arizona constitution. This is something Republicans are worried about. The election is at stake. So Trump is, you know, attempting to get these moderates, try to reassure them a little bit. But I think Inez is right. It's probably not going to work because the media is going to keep demonizing Trump. They're going to keep, you know, painting him as an extremist. And, you know, a lot of voters actually support abortion rights, and they will come out to support things like this Arizona amendment to the Constitution. And so it's going to be a tough, you know, issue for the Republicans to get through. You know, the risk here is that Donald Trump, by issuing statements that appeal to moderates, might turn off, you know, some of the enthusiasm of his base. But I think Inez is right that that's actually probably not going to happen, because, in fact, you know, Christian conservatives are very strongly in favor of Donald Trump, and they have been all along.
It seems to me, Inez, that Trump has understood this strange dynamic that's going on among the Democrats, which is they seem to be cheering on sotto voce, cheering on bans on abortion in various states. For instance, the Arizona Supreme Court decision in favor of this 1860 law, anti-abortion 1860 law. Democrats are treating that as good news because they know it will mobilize their base. They know it's like the, we've talked about this before, it's now like the pro-life issue was for Republicans in the 80s and 90s. It drives out support for them. And so the more abortion bans you have, as much as you may publicly say how horrible it is, the more secretly you're cheering them on.
Yeah, I mean, I predicted at the time when Dobbs came down that this would be much worse for the Republican Party than for the Democratic Party. But I think that's, you know, look, obviously, I come at this from the right, but I think ultimately this is a very good thing. I think it is appropriate that this question return to public discourse, return to the people in the states. And I think it's very good for the American voting public to be able to have a conversation about a complex, difficult moral issue like abortion and actually have that go through the democratic process. Because so much in American politics, particularly in the last 30 years, has been decided either by the courts or by the administrative state. And there has been very little actually of what we might call capital P politics. There's sort of all the sound and fury about who gets elected, but then a narrowing scope of issues upon which those elected officials are actually having a direct impact by legislation, right? And so this is a longstanding dynamic in American politics, but I think it's good for us to sort of exercise those civic muscles of actually having a moral debate about an issue and then going ahead and debating legislation or constitutional amendments in the states. Again, I think this is sort of all to the good for the American public, even though, you know, people feel very, very strongly on this issue, you know, on the particulars of the issue either way. And it's definitely helping Democrat turnout. It's every time one of these constitutional amendments or provisions or is on a state ballot, it helps Democratic turnout. And they're probably, you're right, secretly happy about a lot of those efforts. It's also revealing something to Republican voters, I think, about the Republican position on abortion. Most Republican officials, like Donald Trump, have not really wanted to give an answer. They would like very much to avoid talking about the question, has been sort of the way that this is handled. And I think that's probably valuable for the Republican base to know, for those who feel very strongly pro-life, to know that their representatives who have been fundraising off this issue for the last 30 years are not really interested in expending political capital on that issue and in their favor. So anyway, I think this is sort of healthy and salutary for politics all the way through.
And Trump, who's often much mocked for being stupid, and we probably shouldn't get into a conversation about whether Trump is a genius or an idiot, because that's an endless topic of debate. But he does seem to see the importance of the states in this issue and the importance of moving this away from the Supreme Court, from judicial control, very, very clearly. Whereas a lot of the pro-life, anti-abortion movement don't see it that way. Is that a fair thing to say? It is.
Well, first of all, I should say that my own position as far as the law and the Constitution on this matter, I think, you know, look, I'm not accusing Donald Trump of being a sophisticated constitutional scholar, but I do think he's landed on the constitutional position on abortion. Even for people who are extremely pro-life, they regard every abortion as murder. Murder is very much in the heart of state powers. And I actually doubt the constitutionality of federal abortion legislation. There are lots of people who disagree with me on that. They find a right to life in this way that would encompass these kinds of laws in the 14th Amendment. I just don't find those arguments persuasive legally. That being said, those kinds of distinctions, I think, are mostly, to return to the first thing I said, I don't know that they work in electoral politics, right? People want to know how you feel about a particular issue, and they don't stick around to hear, you know, a lecture on federalism or on the niceties of constitutional law. And this reminds me, actually, if we want to kick it all the way back to 2012, Mitt Romney, who had signed RomneyCare, a version of, you know, public controlled healthcare in his home state of Massachusetts as governor, then had a very, very difficult time talking about Obamacare on the national stage when his answer was, well, yes, it was fine for Massachusetts to do this, but we shouldn't do this nationally. And this is a really bad idea of Obama's nationally, right? That didn't fly with voters. And I suspect that this might be something similar, that if Donald Trump wants to sort of hide behind arguments that I frankly think are correct. I think they're correct constitutionally. I think they're salutary in certain ways for our politics. Purely reading the tea leaves and making my best guess, I don't know that that's going to land or work as a political argument, but we'll see. I mean, this would not be the first time that Donald Trump is able to get away with something that Mitt Romney was not.
Dan, we hear a lot, we've heard a lot this year already about Christian nationalism, and clearly the anti-Trump media are keen to suggest that if Trump wins again, we're on the brink of a Christian nationalist takeover of America. And clearly abortion as an issue plays into this idea. And also a lot of the anti-Trump media and Democratic politicians are talking about IVF, contraceptions. There's some talk about the Comstock Act, which perhaps you can help our British listeners understand a bit. I certainly don't. How effective is that going to be politically? Is this also something that most Americans, independents, are thinking, oh, wow, I'm reading in the media that if Trump is elected, contraception will be banned, and they don't care as much about contraception as Christians do, and so on.
Well, this is the standard, you know, left-wing Democratic playbook. They said the same thing about Ronald Reagan back in the 1980s with the rise of the moral majority. They said the same thing about George W. Bush in the 2000s with the Christian Coalition and other organizations. And now, you know, Donald Trump is supposed to be this man who's going to usher in kind of the Handmaid's Tale version of America if he gets elected to a second term. Now, of course, none of this apocalyptic fear-mongering about Christian nationalism materialized during the first four-year term that Donald Trump served. So I think most people are probably not going to buy into it. It's really a way of stirring up the Democratic base. Christian conservatives do very much support Donald Trump, but of all the, you know, politicians of the last half century who you think might usher in some sort of strongly religious regime, Donald Trump is probably tied with Bill Clinton as the least likely to do it. In fact, maybe even less likely than Bill Clinton. I mean, this is not who Donald Trump is. By the way, I mean, it's interesting to think back that these kinds of concerns, now we're hearing them, you know, directed against evangelical Christians, against, you know, so-called Christian nationalists. But of course, going back 60 years, you heard a lot of these kinds of attacks leveled against John F. Kennedy. Kennedy was a Democrat, but he was the first Catholic who was president of the United States. And so there was this great deal of fear-mongering that if John F. Kennedy became president, he would let the Vatican dictate policy on everything. From, you know, abortion was not so much of an issue at that point, but contraception, that all of America would be put under a kind of, you know, religious regime by JFK and the Vatican. So fear-mongering about Christianity and American religion is a standard trope in American politics, you know, going back decades. And right now it's something that progressives and the left constantly use as an attempt to just stereotype and bash not just Republicans, but Republican voters as well. And while that does stir up the Democratic base, I don't think that ordinary voters really fear that Donald Trump is about to ban condoms or anything like that.
I agree with everything that Dan said. I mean, I think it's completely ludicrous to imagine Donald Trump, of all people, is the guy who's going to ride in on the Christian nationalist banner. As Dan said a couple answers ago, he actually, on a lot of those moral majority issues, classic social conservative issues from the 1990s and 2000s, Donald Trump was on the other side of those issues. And it's actually an indication of how much our culture wars have changed and how much the locus around, like, which issues are considered hot button cultural issues, that Donald Trump, I would argue, has been one of the greatest conservative culture warrior presidents on issues like our history and tearing down our statues, on, you know, the content of American education and how we think about our own country and our past and all those issues. But those are not really the 1990s sort of Christian social conservative classic issues. And on those, he's always been, as Dan pointed out, he's always been a little bit moderate. He's made multiple contradictory statements about abortion. This is not the first time that Donald Trump has vacillated on what his position is on abortion, on gay marriage. He was the first president elected who was in favor publicly of gay marriage, Obama being not in favor of gay marriage when he was first elected and changing his opinion in office. So, I mean, I do think it's primarily fear-mongering. And honestly, like, every 5 years, the New York Times comes up with a new buzzword term to describe the fact that there's a large percentage of American voters who are still, you know, heaven forfend, are actually religious and serious about their religion. It was Dominionist about 5 years ago. That was, you know, a movement of about maybe five people in the United States. Now this idea about Christian nationalism being the driving force of the Republican Party, or even more laughably, Donald Trump. I don't really think that that's the case. And in fact, one of the more interesting developments on the right has been what Nate Hochman called the post-religious right, and the fact that there's a secular right that is in many ways too more extreme than the traditional Christian sort of social conservative right in America. And I think in some ways rightly, in some ways wrongly, but regardless, it is a phenomenon that in fact removing Christianity from the American right has actually not moderated a lot of these, and not moderated the right on a lot of these issues. So a lot of this is just New York Times allergy to anybody who goes to church on Sunday.
That's a fascinating point, and taps into something else that the New York Times seems to be worried about, which is it's not just evangelicals voting for Trump, it's Trump voters becoming evangelicals, which seems to be a new trend. Have you followed that at all?
I haven't. I mean, in fact, that would be contradictory to some of the longer term trends. So back in 2016, there was a pretty sharp divide in the Republican primaries. Most of people who attend church services weekly or religious services weekly, they were in the Cruz camp in the 2016 primaries. They were not Donald Trump voters. In fact, the voters that Donald Trump brought that were new to the party, a lot of them, they might be what we might call nominal Christians who check, they say that they're Christian, but they don't attend weekly or even monthly church services. And actually, there are people largely that describes a lot of the people that Donald Trump has brought into the process. There are people who are sort of atomized and separated from a lot of the civic organizations, and those organizations have been in decline in Trump voting neighborhoods for decades.
Yes.
And so actually, like what Trump brought to the Republican Party was a very different mix of people than the traditional 90s moral majority base of the party. Now, again, like this is no shade on either side of this, but the Republican Party now has these multiple factions working within it. And to describe Donald Trump of all people as a person who is actually sort of bringing more religious fervor to the Republican Party, I think is contrary to the truth, if anything.
Yes. Well, let's not get too distracted with Trump and Christianity, because that is in itself a fascinating subject, and I want to sort of stick on abortion as much as we can. As you, both of you have said there, Trump is a sort of 80s Democrat on abortion, I think it would be fair to say. What's really changed is the Democratic Party on this issue. And if you look at Joe Biden, you know, he has flip-flopped more than Donald Trump when it comes to abortion, and is now basing his entire re-election campaign, or a large part of his election campaign, or I'd say there's a two-plank re-election campaign, which is, one is Donald Trump is very, very bad, and two is abortion rights, and we're going to protect them. Dan, are you surprised at how much confidence the Democrats have in abortion as a winning issue for them?
No, but I think they are overinterpreting some of the results of the 2022 midterm elections. So 2022 was the first midterm, really the first, you know, national election after the Dobbs ruling that overturned Roe versus Wade. And whenever abortion was on the ballot, whenever it seemed to be the issue that was at the top of voters' minds, it seemed to work very strongly in favor of Democrats. And basically, you know, even in Republican states, efforts to protect the unborn, efforts to limit abortion, when they went before popular referenda, they wound up losing. The ballot box politics of abortion seemed in 2022 and in some of the, you know, state elections around the same time, seemed to very strongly favor the Democrats. And so they're looking at 2024 and they're saying this same dynamic will also apply. I think that's partly true, but what will be interesting to discover is how that balances out against having Donald Trump actually on the ballot himself this November. So Donald Trump is going to bring out a lot of Republican voters who probably failed to go to the polls even when abortion was on the ballot in 2022. So in some ways, this is going to be a contest not just between Joe Biden and Donald Trump, but a contest of in terms of what energizes voters the most, either for or against an issue or a candidate. It's going to be partly a contest between abortion rights on the one hand and Donald Trump on the other. And I think there, even Donald Trump is saying things that the right to life voter finds to be a little bit troubling in terms of being middle of the road. Nevertheless, voters are, it'll be an interesting test to see if there are indeed voters who, you know, support things like constitutional amendments to enshrine abortion rights while also voting for Donald Trump. Are there voters who check both of those boxes? There might well be. As Inez has pointed out, you actually had a lot of Donald Trump voters in 2016 and in 2020 as well, who did not look like the traditional Republican, very religious, very socially conservative coalition. It is interesting because things have changed a little bit in the 8 years since 2016. So Donald Trump in Iowa this year, for example, clearly had consolidated his support among Christian conservative voters in a way that he had not done when he was getting started in 2016. So these things are fluid and they are changing. But it will be a very interesting experiment to see whether Donald Trump or abortion is, you know, the thing that people feel most passionate about when they go to the polls this November.
I wonder, Inez, obviously you've had legalized abortion in America for quite a long time now, as we have in Britain. And one of the things we've been talking about internally in the magazine here this week, because there's an abortion debate going on, a very different abortion debate going on in the UK, is that in our societies, in our high abortion societies, where I think in Britain and America it's about 1/4 or to 1/5 of all conceptions end in abortion, whether there can actually, the pro-life, the anti-abortion argument can actually win anymore, because so many people who live in society have either had or known someone who's had or been, we are all connected in some way to abortions. And it's very hard for a society to have some sort of reckoning about abortion once you've been doing it for so long. What do you think about that, Inez?
I think that's probably true. And it's one of the many parallels that I think do make political sense about slavery, for example, before the Civil War, when you have this deep divide on an issue that is intertwined, really, with life. And as you say, like where everybody has been touched by it or at least by first or second degree, right? It is a difficult discussion. I don't know that it means that the tide will never turn. In the short term, what's happened is Americans have gone from a relatively moderate position on abortion. The mean position before Dobbs came down was in favor of abortion through the first trimester, and then, you know, a lot more people getting squeamish about it in the second trimester, and definitely a strong majority, sometimes as much as 70 or 80% against third trimester abortions. You know, exceptions for rape and incest poll very high, but generally the mean American position was it's okay in the first trimester, uncomfortable from there on out, right? And then blending into very much against it. What we're seeing is that when actually asked on the ballot on some of these questions, even very extreme pro-choice ballot measures tend to pass, right? So even the proposition of abortion on demand for all 9 months of pregnancy right up until the delivery room does quite well or has done quite well at the ballot box. Now, I think Dan made a good point about who's excited about these issues. It may very well be that there are more Democrats excited to vote for the pro-choice position, whereas Republicans, even pro-life Republicans, may not be as enthusiastic about the issue, or they may be fewer of them that are enthusiastic at turning out on this issue, whereas if Donald Trump is on the ballot, they'll be turning out for Donald Trump and then, incidentally, going to vote against some of these ballot measures. But the evidence that we have is people's position is actually sliding the opposite direction. And so it is a challenge to the pro-life movement. They are going to have to persuade their fellow Americans of their views about this issue and about the, you know, the personhood of the fetus prior to birth. And right now, it seems like they're actually losing ground. And I think that's in part because they were unprepared to make these arguments directly to the people. And in part because Republican politicians are running away from the question. And maybe this does speak to sort of the poverty of our discourse. I mean, the thinking back to George W. Bush and the debate about stem cells, right, which in some ways you would think is actually a really, really difficult question in the sense that there was so much promise for this kind of research. And then on the other hand, you had people who were raising ethical objections to essentially medical research on human embryos. And that debate, I remember just taking place, you know, Professor Robbie P. George was on NPR having these discussions. There was a Council of Bioethics, and we had this discussion at a higher level. So, I mean, I hope the more we have this discussion, then the more the average American is going to have to actually examine his or her beliefs about these complicated moral questions. But as of right now, there's just a lot of straight out misinformation in the debate. The left loves that word, so I'm going to use it. Stuff about, for example, banning contraception. There is not a single viable effort in any state to ban contraception. That's simply not something on the Republican agenda in any state whatsoever. So there's just like a lot of hyperbole, a lot of, you know, flat out lies flying around back and forth. And, you know, I hope we can return to have an actual discussion about complicated moral issues. In fact, that's kind of our mandate as a, at least allegedly self-governing people.
Dan, you mentioned The Handmaid's Tale earlier, and what Inez is talking about there touches on this, that there is this almost eagerness among large parts of the population, particularly women, I think it should be said, in Britain and in America, to see any serious discussion about this as an attempt to bring back the patriarchy, to make women slaves and chattels and so on. Do you think that the argument has become so sentimental now that it's not possible for politicians to have rational debates about it? And even Trump himself, in his statement on Monday, he turns it into a, you know, he talked about IVF and he said, I love, you know, what could be more beautiful than a father and a mother wanting to have a baby and so on. Are we just living in times where we can't talk about serious moral subjects?
Well, part of the difficulty is that the extremes actually have more consistent positions than the middle does. So when it's a matter of sentimentality, there is a certain give and take. People, on the one hand, care about women. They want to see that, you know, especially victims of rape and incest, that they want to, you know, make sure that there's a compassionate approach towards them. They also, of course, care about babies. And as Ina said, when you get to the third term of abortion, it's very clear that an unborn, you know, fetus and a newborn baby are very similar indeed. And so Republicans were very successful in talking about an issue they framed as partial birth abortion, which was, you know, almost a complete delivery of the baby, except for the head, at which point, you know, you have a doctor jamming scissors into the head of the baby being born and killing it. So those are emotional issues. And so, you know, one of the biggest points in favor of the pro-life argument on an emotional level were ultrasound scans that, and today, in fact, so Freddie, you had mentioned that, you know, so many people know women who've had abortions that maybe this affects the way that we talk about the issue. But keep in mind also, all of your friends you see on Facebook and on other social media sharing ultrasound scans of their pregnancies at the very earliest stages. This too, you know, tremendously moves public opinion. And people are talking about the ultrasound images they have as, this is already my child, this is my baby. That really, I think, shifts people sentimentally and emotionally. Previously, it had worked very well in terms of making them more pro-life. Right now, we're in a situation where that seems to have been arrested in terms of its effect, but we'll see if that continues to be the case. Now, on the intellectual side, this is the difficult thing here, is that there actually is a serious intellectual argument against, for example, Griswold v. Connecticut, which was the decision which ultimately, you know, made contraception effectively legal everywhere in the United States. It's not as if, you know, even pre-Griswold, there were all these strenuous attempts to stop contraception from being legal, but Griswold basically created rights that now enshrine contraception availability almost everywhere. There is a good legal argument to be made against Griswold. There are, you know, sort of strong moral arguments, intellectually serious moral arguments derived from natural law and from Catholic theology and Christian theology in general. These are sophisticated arguments that actually would be much more extreme or much more 100% in one direction than most even Republicans or even most Christian or Catholic voters would be comfortable staking out. And similarly, on the other side, I mean, if you believe that the unborn child is not actually a human life, then the question is, well, why wouldn't you support partial birth abortion? In fact, the question really becomes, why would you not even support infanticide of newborn infants if they're inconvenient? I mean, what is the point at which, if you are in favor of abortion rights, you say that a child actually becomes a child rather than simply a clump of cells? That's a very hard philosophical question. So, and you have this tendency in America because, you know, we are very, you know, abstract people. We like to discuss these really tough intellectual questions, but that doesn't fit very well with the way democratic politics actually works, small d democratic politics. That in fact, you know, publics, you know, the people, they like to, you know, operate on a more sentimental basis, and that sentimental basis tends to be more moderate than the philosophically rigorous views of either the pro-life or pro-choice, more serious thinkers.
You know, I myself am against the reasoning in Griswold, but as we see with Dobbs and Roe v. Wade, it's entirely possible for the imaginary constitutional right on a basis that I think has been very legally pernicious within our constitutional system to result in, if that case being, you know, is overturned, to result in fact, a shoring up of the substantive quote unquote right in the states, right, when it's actually put to the people. So those two things are separable. I agree with Dan that there are intellectually consistent arguments to be made and serious ones, but I don't, like, as a matter of practical politics, that there is no, that I'm aware, in any state, in any of the 50 states, even the most conservative states, there is no actual practical effort to attempt to make birth control illegal. And this is something that is regularly stated, and as Dan pointed out, is stated every election cycle by Democrats, right? This is not the first time that we've heard that Republicans are out to ban birth control. And for good or ill, the opposite is true. I mean, there have been Republican legislative efforts to make birth control over the counter. So I just don't see any lineup between the way that elected Republicans in office, even in very red states, are behaving and some of the intellectual arguments that Dan is pointing to. And as a matter of practicality, it's simply just, it is an invention of the left that there is any pragmatic chance of something akin to a birth control ban passing in any state, let alone many states or on the federal level.
Well, that's all true. I you know, and I think that's exactly right about the politics. For the pro-life side, this is a major concern, however, because both with IVF, which involves, you know, freezing embryos, and then, you know, ultimately, if those embryos are not going to be implanted or are not going to be viable after a certain point, it's tantamount to, in the pro-life point of view, an abortion, because it's the, you know, creation and then destruction of an embryo. Similarly, there are certain, you know, there are concerns among pro-lifers that many kinds of contraception, birth control, especially morning after pills and other things, that these are abortifacients, or that they can have abortifacient effects in some cases. And this too is something that goes to the very heart of the philosophical and intellectual basis for the pro-life campaign. And there's a concern, I think, among pro-lifers. And again, I'm not, you know, disputing Inez about the ballot box politics of this. But for the pro-life movement itself, the concern is that if you concede things like IVF, or you concede, you know, some of the forms of birth control that may have abortifacient potential, that you will then, in fact, be conceding the very principle that you're founding your opposition to abortion on as well. And if you start to, you know, do away with that principle, then the entire house of cards will collapse.
Thank you both very, very much for coming on and shedding some light on the debate about abortion in America, because particularly for our British listeners, I think we don't get a very clear sense of what it's all about. And I think you have both provided a lot of insight on it. So thank you very much, both.
Thank you.
Thanks, Freddie.
That's it for that episode of the Americano podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to it. I'd like to thank our brilliant Spectator production team, Natasha Farrows, my producer, Oscar Edmondson, who's sitting opposite me. And I would like to ask any listeners who have ideas as to who they think I should get on the podcast. We're going to be doing two a week, so we have to come up with plenty of ideas this year. And often you have much better ideas than I do. So please do get in touch if you have an idea of a guest that you think we should try and get on the show, or a subject that you think we haven't covered that we should be covering. And please email that to podcast@spectator.co.uk, or you can get in touch with me directly on Twitter. I think my handle is freddiegray31, which is depressingly how old I was when I set up my Twitter account. Okay, please do that. Goodbye.